Okay, are these on? They are on. Okay, so some of you may be expecting Susan Bonds of 42 Entertainment. None of us are Susan Bonds of 42 Entertainment, but we will be doing the panel that's coming up at 3:30. So don't be embarrassed if you came to see Susan and you're very upset. You can tune into us if you like. Should we kick things off? We're a little early.
Are we?
No, I think we're
yeah,
early.
Give us a few minutes,
wait.
I guess.
Yeah, we can wait.
Yeah.
It's actually quite a good turnout.
It's not a bad turnout. And no one left.
No one left, but we haven't started yet.
We haven't started yet, yeah.
There's always time.
We should maybe pause in the middle and give them a chance.
I think we might.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just tackle them on the way out.
Oh, like for the beer. I heard about it, but
oh, good for you.
Oh, really?
Great.
I'm Dee Cook.
Freddie, I'm Tony. How you doing?
Hi.
Thanks for coming up. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think we all sympathize with that.
You could never be.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Well, when we open it up for conversation, then jump on in, okay?
Freddie, like
it might have. I didn't really read about it.
I feel like I need to have like Google by my side.
Wait, hang on. What? Who's that? That other person?
That's the panel. The panel's coming.
Oh. Yeah, we'll give them another couple minutes. They've got those doors open. Okay.
I don't think I can live blog this.
I don't think you can live blog it while you're giving a panel. Maybe you should.
It sounds like a challenge. The gauntlet is tossed.
We'll actually only do this in text.
We'll be performing this panel on Meebo.
What's the URL for it?
Oh, this?
Is it on the...
It's
the Meebo
very lengthy. Oh, no, I don't know.
That's really nice. Everyone else can talk about this behind it.
What, there's a back channel for this?
Yeah.
Meebo.com/SXSW.
What?
Then you click on the panel there. I think I'd rather not.
Put the back channel up.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. That's probably a good idea. Show me where it is on the interface.
Meebo.com/SXSW.
It's not. You have to go to meebo.com/.
That's not the best. Okay, good.
Yeah. And then select ours.
Oh. Should we kick things off here?
Do that thing.
Which?
Do that thing.
Oh.
That thing you do.
So I'm going to try to tune into the back channel for this so you guys can all see what you're saying on here. Yeah. We're keeping things all...
So we'll watch that.
Open and transparent. Did you see it?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Oh, no plug-in.
Fail.
No plug-in. All right, well, so here's the deal. So we are a replacement panel for a previous panel that had been scheduled with Susan Bonds of 42 Entertainment to talk about ARGs as the future of entertainment. We are not going to talk about that, but we are going to talk about ARGs, and we're also going to talk about computer and video games and how the ARG game form, alternate reality game form, and the video game form can intermingle and learn a bit from each other. So just to kick things off, my name is Tony Walsh. I am the director of an interactive studio based in Toronto called Phantom Compass. I have worked as a freelancer for about 14 years, which included work on a few alternate reality games, including Fallen, alternate reality game, which won a South by Southwest Web Award last year, and Regenesis alternate reality game series. And I will leave it up to my cohorts to introduce themselves. Dee?
My name is Dee Cook. I'm a freelancer also. I guess you're not a freelancer anymore. but I am now. And I have been working on alternate reality games, or ARGs, since 2003, working on various grassroots and professional campaigns.
And your ARG is up for South by Southwest Award this year.
I was glad to work on World Without Oil, and it is up for an award in the activism category for tomorrow night. So cross your fingers.
Pretty good.
I'm Dan Hon. I'm a co-founder and CEO of an ARG cross-media entertainment agency called Six to Start in London. The last major game that I worked on was Perplex City, which was released by Mind Candy. And at the moment, we've kicked off a number of major projects, the biggest of which is with Channel 4 Education in the UK. And we're also doing some extra projects with some publishers that I hopefully can talk about later this week when my client lets me.
So you may notice that neither of the three of us actually have extensive experience in video game development. And while I've worked fairly regularly in web game development, and I've been an avid gamer for quite some time, a couple decades maybe, what we're looking at is are things admittedly from an alternate reality game perspective. And so we're going to open things up for discussion in Q&A, and we're hoping that if anybody here happens to be in the video game or computer game development industry, please join in particular, because we're sort of we're coming at things definitely from an ARG slant. So just before we get into things too much, I think it's kind of obligatory in case there, I don't know what the experience level on the original panel was set to, probably beginner or possibly intermediate, but let's do the obligatory, what is an alternate reality game?
Why don't we ask them?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Who wants to, I can't do that. We can't do that. Dan, what's an alternate reality game?
Okay. Well, the way that we explain alternate reality games is that they're a new way of telling stories. We use lots of different kind of media. So we use websites, we use print ads, we use TV, we use radio, we use skywriting. There are people hiding phones in cakes. There are what are the other things that people have done?
Black helicopters.
Black helicopters. They're surprisingly cheap and effective for buzzing people. So there's a tip. So one of the things that we say is that people consume lots of different kinds of media today, and it's becoming increasingly apparent that in this kind of on-demand, I want everything and I want it now kind of world, that there is a different kind of experience, a different kind of narrative and gameplay experience that you can offer people through when you design an experience that's from the ground up supposed to be experienced through multiple media in the first place. So some of the other examples that we give are that ARGs are games where you don't necessarily have to learn a specific control scheme or anything. So you don't need to learn the myriad of commands that you would need to do to play World of Warcraft. You don't need to add all the interface add-ons and everything. It's not like playing Civilization, where you've got to learn all the commands there as well, and it's also not like a game for a console. The user interactions and the gameplay interactions that we have, and the narrative interactions in an ARG, are typically using the same tools that you would use in everyday life. So, if you want to correspond, if you want to talk to a character, if you want to find information from a non-player character, from an NPC in an ARG, you would typically do that by calling them up or sending them a text message or sending them an email. So you would do that using all of the methods of communication that you're already familiar with. So the learning curve is very, very low. And at the same time, when there are tasks and when there are kind of the analogies to RPG quests that you would have to do in an ARG, you would typically do them through, in some cases, websites that resemble real-world sites. So you might be asked to try and find out some banking information to get a background check on someone. So you would go to a site that, for all intents and purposes, looks like a normal bank website, and then you'd have to put the right username and password in there to find out what's going on.
Why don't we hop over to Dee, because you had a really good summation of the whole ARG experience.
You know, it's really one of these things that's so hard to define, and I think the rules have been that there are no rules mm-hmm. about what an ARG is. And by the way, some of us call it ARG, some of us call it ARG. It's all the same thing. There's a division in the genre. But anyway, so I think how I mostly describe it to people is that it's like playing a murder mystery dinner theater. only instead of just a couple of hours in an evening, you may be playing for weeks or months, and you can be playing online, in person, on the telephone, via mail, via email. However, it can come at you from all directions, and it can touch you in your life as well as...
So it would be the characters in the murder mystery may follow you home.
Right. Hide your
and then call you up in stock.
Well, although what frequently happens is that our players end up following the actors in the murder mystery home.
Right, I guess that's one thing that we can talk about too is unlike a lot of other game formats, the players of alternate reality games can be extremely voracious, very, very hungry. Well, this is the same, I guess, for a lot of different game forms. Mm-hmm. Very, very hungry for content and always coming up with things that the game designers might not have anticipated or expected, and also developing their own. They may come up with an idea as part of the mystery of the game, solving the game, that may become so important to them that you as the game maker have no choice but to respond by accepting their narrative or their storyline.
Right.
So it's almost a little bit like improvisational theater in the sense that one of the rules is don't block, right? So you want to accept and accept what's happening. This, of course, creates interesting challenges in terms of developing this content. It becomes almost a little bit like a live television show for some games, where you've got a team that's sort of monitoring what's happening with the players and responding to that almost in real time. So contingencies and stuff like that come into play quite a bit. So that's a good little slice off the top. Is anyone still, are there holes in the explanation that we gave for ARGs? Is it safe to, yeah, okay. So that's good. Everyone seems pretty good. Yeah. Who are the players?
So some of the information that we got when I was at Mind Candy on Perplex City was that the demographic data that we had players ranging from about 12 years old through to about 80. The gender split was 50-50 male-female. And the live events that we ran, and typically what you see when you do live events for any ARG, is that the people who turn up will surprise you. Not in that they're the kind of people who you stereotypically assume to be male living in their parents' basement, but in that families will come. So, you will have three generations of people coming out and making a day of it. So I would not say that the typical audience for an ARG is a stereotypical gamer hardcore audience. I'd say that it cuts a very wide swath across. You've got very casual people who kind of dip in and dip out, and then you do have very, very hardcore people who try and find out where you get the black helicopters from.
There are different elements of each game that appeal to different types of players, and I think that's one really good thing about the game form is everyone can participate in some way, whether it's casual participation or cracking military strength encryption codes.
I wanted to say, when Dan said that there's no particular control, moves that you have to learn on the controller to play an ARG, that's not to say that there aren't skill sets that come in handy. And with each game, the skill set that comes in handy may be completely different. One game may require, wasn't there a puzzle about loot tablature?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Knowing
Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Right, right. Really arcane knowledge can come into play. So even people who don't think that they have, I can't crack codes, well, they may bring something really special to the table that nobody else has. And the bigger your audience, the more chance that you have of funneling that specialized knowledge exactly to where it needs to go.
I think one thing to bear in mind when thinking about ARGs is that they are, like video games, they are a form of entertainment. So sometimes the question, who plays these, doesn't really make much sense because it's such a broad question that could be answered in so many different ways. It's like asking who watches movies or who reads books. When you have a very wide genre classification like that, it's probably more helpful to talk about, okay, well, who played this game or who played that game or who watched this movie or who watches this TV channel?
One thing we can do, though, is we can talk a little bit about how video game players and ARG players might be, quite different in the sense that, video game players are looking for something. And by the way, we're not defining what video games are because you all know, and we're defining what alternate reality games are because still, for a lot of people, it's an unfamiliar genre. But video game players, the kinds of people who play video games, are, I think, in a lot of ways, very different from the people who play alternate reality games, which is a much more methodical, thorough, almost research-oriented type of gameplay.
I think they can be. I think there are definitely differences between the types of gameplay. I mean, like, so when we were talking earlier about about some of this. We were saying that there are some video games that you can look at where they are long series of long expanses of gameplay that are punctuated by short narrative cutscenes. And that's one style of gameplay. And then you've got other games like Half-Life and Portal, where the story and the world is brought to you kind of organically and in the background. But the cutscene is one way of that. Now, ARGs, one way of looking at them is that they can be more predominantly storyline based, so that it is one long story that can play out live over, say, a period of 12 to 16 or even weeks or even 2 years, that are punctuated by short periods of game-like play.
So how does that relate back then to the what kinds of players play, right? Like, so video game players are one kind of player, maybe action-oriented. What kind of player plays an ARG? Not from necessarily demographics, but what are they looking for in an alternate reality game that maybe they're not getting in a video game?
I think so it's useful to look at some of the examples of previous ARGs. A lot of the successful ones have been tied to very, very rich, deep brands. So you've got I Love Bees, which was a campaign by 42 Entertainment to tie in with the launch of Halo 2. Now, the thing about Halo 2 is that you can either look at it in one way as an FPS that frat boys love to play, Or you can look at it in a completely different way, which is that Bungie started the line of games that started way back when on the Mac with something called Marathon. And they put together an incredibly detailed backstory that you didn't really need to get into, but it was an example of, you know, really good craft in storytelling and really good craft in world building. Mm-hmm. And for the really, really hardcore fans, for the people who buy into a story, buy into characters, and buy into the world, they get really passionate about that. And any hint of more information about that world, it's kind of like, you know, teasers for the next Harry Potter movie or when J.K. Rowling's going to release her next book or finding out what's going to be in the next Indiana Jones movie. When there's that rich lore and mythology, that can be one way that people can be really passionate about and that can draw people into a game.
I think that another thing that people feel really strongly about in ARGs is the fact that they feel like they can affect the game world, mm-hmm. and sometimes even completely change its vector. They can also, not always, but often they can interact with the characters and get the sense that they're interacting with a real person rather than in a video game. You can interact with characters, but you know that it's programming.
And there's almost a history to the interactions that occur in ARGs where you know, it's usually a one-shot game. You don't play the same ARG over and over again. So the events that take place in the alternate reality game are events that have with them memories and history. And that's something that a lot of video games don't really have, I think.
Unless it's an MMO.
Right. And then the memory is actually, usually it's between the players.
Right.
It's, we did this and we did that as players, because they are actually creating their own story within a game like World of Warcraft or EverQuest. Mm-hmm. But an NPC will never really remember you in a satisfying way in a game like that.
Right.
No, I mean, definitely. I think World of Warcraft is, as a single player experience, even though it's an MMO, is an incredibly boring game. As soon as you get into a grouping of players, if you're playing with friends, I think it's a completely different experience. And that's the kind of experience that that ARGs, just in the nature that they've been constructed and the way that people have been playing them, when they play in very, very large groups, and it's very easy for people to make that kind of social gameplay mechanic happen, rather than, and it's almost as an alternative or augmenting the gameplay that's already there.
Yeah, I mean, there's not enough of the game there, I think, to sustain, you know, extended play. Can we talk a little bit about, you started to talk a bit about I Love Bees. Maybe we should talk about some early alternate reality games just quickly so that you have an idea of the foundation. And there have been connections to the video game world early on. And so who wants to talk about Majestic?
I was a beta tester on Majestic. And I
played... First of all, what was it?
Oh, Majestic. Okay, so Electronic Arts... started advertising the game that plays you. And it talked about how it was going to, I don't know if they actually used the word intrude, but how it was going to become part of your real life and how the game was going to call you and how it was going to message you when you were online and things like that. And it really intrigued a lot of people who thought, you know, this is kind of the next step. This is almost a little bit scary, but it's fun and it's thrilling too. So they introduced this game called Majestic, and it had some interface issues, and it wasn't exactly as realistic as it could have been. It had a lot of promise, but I think in execution, and there have been some good postmortems on the web. Mm-hmm. If you get a chance and you're interested, there's a good one posted by one of the developers about what went wrong there. But that was my introduction to the whole scene, and it shut down shortly after September 11th. It has some terrorism plot lines and things like that, and I think it was also having financial issues also. But running pretty much concurrently with that was The Beast, which I think that Dan can probably eloquently talk about.
So The Beast came out of Microsoft Game Studios and was a Skunkworks project there that was initiated by Jordan Weissman when he was still there, and run by Ilan Lee and written by Sean Stewart. It was tied into the promotion of AI, the Steven Spielberg movie, and what it did, it set a number of precedents and kind of, at the very least, guiding principles as to what some people believe an ARG should or might ought to strive to be. One of the interesting things that it did for a straight marketing campaign was not admit that it was a marketing campaign. So it took itself very, very seriously. There was this fiction about this chap called Evan Chan who had been murdered. And if you watched the trailer for the movie, then you'd see, if you're a certain kind of person, you would see a credit for someone called Janine Salla. And she was credited as a sentient machine therapist. And this was back in 2001, so it was very, very easy to Google for that phrase. And then people started finding her website. They found her family site, which linked to her page at a university faculty. And then that university faculty had other links to other sites. And what happened was that this game created a universe. It had a fictional universe, much like any other kind of narrative. But it realized it online in a very different way that hadn't really been done before and that was very much more cohesive. Interestingly, though, in terms of gameplay, even though it came out of Microsoft Game Studios, there wasn't really any traditional video game gameplay mechanic in there. And I think this is something that Tony and I were talking about before. There's no Twitch. There's no FPS-style gameplay. There's puzzle solving, and there's collaborative puzzle solving, where, again, you might need to look something up in loot tablature, and the puzzles and the things that you have to do make sense within the context of the narrative. But there are no, it's not a game like Tomb Raider, it's not a racing game, there isn't anything that you do like that. It's very much a kind of investigative genre kind of game.
So it's a little surprising, you know, that EA and Microsoft, who both make Twitch games, would actually have experimented with this medium to begin with, really.
Definitely. I mean, I think for me, ARGs definitely have been much more about storytelling and much more about a narrative experience than traditional gameplay so far. The gameplay that tends to emerge out of them is very social based. It's very much more kind of like Web 2.0 web social than conventional sit down in front of the TV with a console or install something like WoW on your PC.
And so that wasn't the... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it definitely is a big community builder. And I think that a lot of our more modern ARGs can trace their roots, you know, all the way back to War of the Worlds, as far as the fictional reality taking place. And
War of the Worlds, the radio play.
The radio play that Orson Welles did. And, you know, there was another one that Pink Floyd did in the 90s called Publius Enigma, which was never resolved. Blair Witch was another reality that was kind of took itself very seriously. This is not a game. And so all of those things have kind of, I guess, what do you call it? They've rolled into what we have now.
Yeah, the form is so always evolving, which makes it an exciting form to work in. Maybe we can talk a little bit about Microsoft's other project, which was I Love Bees. I know that you did mention it, and let's just quickly summarize it for these folks so they have another idea of another one of the foundational games.
So again, the interesting thing about about I Love Bees was that if you look at some descriptions of the project, it was more of a radio play. And I think, in fact, I probably want to double check this, but I think what one of the writers, Sean, said was that they wanted to find a way to kind of take a conventional radio play and work out a way to present it to an audience that would have no idea what a radio play was or would normally never sit down and listen to, you know, 90, 120 minutes of straight audio drama. And how do you make that interesting? And can you even tell stories using that way or in a different way to audiences nowadays?
Now, this was a promotion for Halo 2.
Yeah.
And they did try to do something. Microsoft tried to do something with Halo 3. It was mostly unresolved or it didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
That one.
That was the adjutant reflex.
Yeah. I don't, was that official?
I do not know. So yeah. I guess that's one thing we can talk about too, in terms of, you know, for the video game scene, there's quite an active independent game development mm-hmm. scene. There's independent game conferences with alternate reality games as well. There's a huge grassroots movement to produce your own games. I mean, it could be rocket science, but it isn't rocket science. And it's a community that encourages people to come up from the fringes and develop their own games and to try their hand at this. The barrier to entry is a lot lower than computer and video game development. You don't need to be extremely technology savvy. If you can run a blog, you can run your own alternate reality game. If you can call people up on the telephone, if you can fax people, if you can act in character in an instant messaging chat room, you can run your own ARG. And so that sort of grassroots aspect of it, I think, is really cool. In terms of the earlier question, who plays these things, it's also an interesting question to ask who makes these things. It's kind of good that the evolution, I think, is spurred on a lot by fan-created productions. Whereas the video games industry, too, is a lot of independently created game concepts and ideas are responsible for a lot of the innovation. Dan's pretty good to answer this one because Perplexity is one of the few measurably successful ARGs.
So the question was, what's the reach of an ARG? And that a lot of the examples that we've talked about today at this panel have been, you know, marketing for brands. Have there been any business models? So on the business model side, Majestic was a subscription game that EA released, the audience and the market clearly wasn't ready for that at the time, but that was a good kind of six, seven years ago. Perplexity was another ARG which interestingly marketed itself. So the business model behind that was a series of collectible puzzle cards, much along the line of Magic the Gathering. So there would be a set of 256 cards. You'd buy randomized packs, and then you'd try and collect them all, and then those packs would have clues that would help you solve the greater mystery. Being perfectly honest, in terms of business models, I think everyone's still trying to work that out. There is, in the same way that people are looking for business models for, I guess, online video, there is definitely a lot of scope for brand-sponsored content. So a lot of the projects that my studio is working on, we're working on projects for brands. But again, in terms of a self-sustaining, independent ARG, it's still something that people are working on.
I think you're also still running up against the internet should be free philosophy.
Yeah.
Majestic did have a problem with subscription fees, and that was in 2001 because the internet should be free. I mean, that's what the whole philosophy was. And I think that there is still a large component of people who believe that today. So having a subscription based anything on the internet is a dicey proposition.
I think, one of the other things we were talking about is, you know, it is possible to get people to pay a subscription fee for something where they're going to spend a lot of time. I mean, the people who really play ARGs put a lot of time and effort into playing them. About as much as a hardcore World of Warcraft player. So,
and it's good that you mentioned that because I wanted to bring it back to video games. And I don't know if anyone was in the What Teens Want panel this morning, but it, you know, one of the teams was articulating something that seems to be a bit of a movement in this sort of MMO and social gaming spaces, which is, you know, the idea of a subscription model is not holding a lot of water these days, and that the free-to-play model is sort of creeping up there. And so that ties into what Dee's saying, you know, information should be free and the internet should be free. And I think a lot of, especially young gamers, are looking at these free-to-play games, whether that means that they're ad-supported games, so that there's banner ads that surround the game content, or there's in-game advertising, and so that's why it's free-to-play, or if it's free-to-play, but if you want item upgrades, you pay for that. So that's a very successful model right now in, say, like Korea, for example. Yep. That is, I don't know if I can repeat that question. I just realized I should be repeating this stuff.
Totally
zoning out. Can you summarize
that? Okay. So, is what teens are expecting in terms of free to play being paralleled, I think, by people wanting to find themselves in a game, as opposed to looking for a game to play? Was that was the question? Yeah. And also the example there was Lonely Girl. So, Lonely Girl again is interesting because, it didn't start out as an ARG. The whole suspense behind Lonely Girl was, is this real or not? And that wasn't something that I don't believe the creators really had thought about much. And again, so you've got things like the follow-up series, Kate Modern, which is on Bebo in the UK, where the creators of Lonely Girl very quickly figured out that the back and forth that you have, that kind of interaction in an ARG where you watch what the audience does and you set the audience tasks and then they do that and then you're much more responsive to your audience, can add a lot of value, to the entertainment that you're producing. The question about finding yourself in a game, as opposed to finding a game, is hard from a production and delivery point of view. Because the thing is, it's very easy to see clues out there. So on the games that I've worked on, we've done stuff like hide classified ads, we've done skywriting, we've put stickers in places, and we've done all this kind of, on the one hand, very traditional viral guerrilla type marketing, that on the one hand is marketing for the game, but is also part of the game itself. But that will not get you your massive audience quickly enough. What you really want to be doing, and a large part of the equation, is being able to push people towards the game in the first place.
He's been having
sure. I mean, just before we get too much into the questions, I'm happy to take questions right now because we wanted to keep things fairly conversational. I just want to make sure we bring everything back to the panel topic. So why don't you step up to the mic and let us know what you wanted to say.
Yeah, on the other side of the business model question, there seems to be such a clear tie between some of these games and making social change. For instance, World Without Oil, you have this group of dynamic people who are interested in oil issues. What kind of ties are you seeing between the games and civic engagement and actually making some change revolving around the issues that the games are about?
So my brother and co-founder, actually, are you on the judging panel?
I am not.
Anyway, so my brother and co-founder, Adrian, has a project called Let's Change the Game, which he's running in conjunction with the Cancer Research charity in the UK, which is the largest organization undertaking research into fighting cancer in the UK. And what they've done is they've been able to raise a sum of money for independent grassroots developers to put together an alternate reality game that will use that kind of power of marketing, that power of narrative, and getting people out there to do things to raise money for cancer research. And again, you know, I imagine Dee's got a lot to say about World Without Oil.
World Without Oil has really not ended in many ways. There's still people who are keeping up with the lifestyle that they developed during the run time of the game itself.
What was the premise of that experience?
The premise, I'm sorry, the World Without Oil was, imagine that you are in an oil shock. And the gas prices have skyrocketed. That oil has become unobtainable in several places. You can't travel very much anymore. Think of anything you can use oil for, and there was a shortage of it. And what we asked the players to do was put themselves in this position write to us, or blog, or video, or podcast, or some people did cartoons. I mean, it was amazing, all the user-generated content that came in. Submit it to the website, and let's have a sort of a central hub where people could talk about what they were doing in this catastrophe. And so, like I said, people are still taking the lessons that they learned during World Without Oil and learning from other players and putting it into action in their day-to-day lives.
And from my own experience, I worked on a game called Waking City that was done by a group called Tour Game in Toronto, and it involved traveling around the city and solving puzzles and meeting characters that sort of inhabited, were like embodiments of the city. So while there was maybe no... I don't know if there was like a real outcome out of that, except for people discovering areas and aspects of the city and elements of the history of the city that they'd never experienced before. So there's plenty of good that can be done. And again, to bring it back to video games, Sony, it's almost like with ARGs, you're looking at distributed human computing. But on the flip side with video games, you can kind of do the same thing. Sony, it runs Folding at Home, I think, for the PS3, which is like this program that runs cancer-busting stuff. I don't know the technical. I'm not technical. it's probably for another panel another time, but, you know, what could you do if you harnessed the collective power of World of Warcraft players? Can you work into game mechanics a way to screen, you know, cancer tests, or, you know, maybe World of Warcraft is not a great example, but Star Wars Galaxies could be, where you've got medics and medical charts and stuff like that. So just wanted to bring it back.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that's been really interesting for us. So two big projects that we're working on at the moment, one of which is a project for Channel 4 Education. Now, what ARGs can be really, really good at is teaching very important life skills. They can be very good at teaching how to collaborate with people, how to critically evaluate sources, how to behave appropriately in certain circumstances, role-playing. They can be used a lot to figure out what it is that you want to do in your life. So one of the things that we're doing is we're designing a game for 14 to 16-year-olds around the nature of online identity and privacy. And it's through ARGs that I think the application of gameplay and play-like principles that you can normally get people to do things that they wouldn't otherwise normally do, especially when combined with the story of a really good narrative, and a really good narrative experience.
Did you want to add anything,
Andy? I think he said it.
Okay, can we take the next question? I guess. Oop, sorry. I guess probably best if you step up to the mic, if you don't mind. Yeah.
Hi. I research storytelling and narratology. That's why ARGs are really phenomenally exciting for me. However, I listen to a lot of ARCnet postcards, and I look at what's going on certain ARGs. What really concerns me, and the comment that you made earlier at the beginning, Tony, kind of brought back to me. I was listening to this podcast, and they were talking about head trauma and Hope is Missing, mm-hmm. right? And their first, I think, movie showing, they had people like following the people who came there.
Yep, yep.
And that's really freaky. But actually, it's not really limited to that game. It's kind of when you blend and merge reality with fiction,
sure.
then you're getting into this suable ground. Like, I'm almost expecting something to explode, because the crowd, like we as the art community, are pretty savvy about, you know, we would look for clues, or we'd say, that's just gameplay or whatever. But there's this huge community of unsuspecting people.
Right.
When they watch a video on Hope is Missing, they really think that this woman is missing, and then they just really freak out because they were duped.
Yeah.
And we saw this in Lonely Girl 15 too.
Yeah, this happens. I mean, you know, this question actually comes up almost every time I talk about ARGs, and I'm sure for you guys too,
definitely.
Is, you know, there's a line, a legal line where where does the gameplay stop? You know, it's almost like certain sexual practices where you have a safety word. You know what I mean? Like, there's got to be a way that you.
Well, I mean,
if you're laughing, you know what I'm talking about.
Everyone, exactly.
But also, like, for example, I was looking at some of the hacks that were going on in ARGs. I've done some research on griefing as well, so that's why I was like really interested in that. Mm-hmm. Like, you were talking about this collective intelligence. Like, we are a bunch of smart moths. You set us loose on an internet, and then the amount of private information that we can find out about puppet masters
right.
or the players mm-hmm. are just mind-numbing.
Right, and so, I mean, it's up to
why
the
we're making our game.
Yeah, it's up to the designers of the game to really be intelligent about how they're going to create game mechanics and create situations.
Can you control that though?
To a degree.
Honestly, no. You can't control it.
And what you can't control, you have lawyers to protect you against. So, I mean, this is, you know, lawyers get very nervous around stuff like this. You know, it's not anything could happen, right? I mean, you know, anybody at any time, you know, someone could stand up in here and do something completely crazy and unexpected, right? And there's nothing that we can really do to protect against that.
This is also what insurance is for.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, something that Tony said earlier in the green room was that you can't really anticipate everything that anybody is going to do, but what you can be is prepared to act quickly and react.
And so this is another area, say, you know, with video games, it's very predictable what you're permitting the player to do. You set up affordances in the game design and you can only do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, that you start to break down, the more people that you add into the mix, that more that starts to break down. So in the more massively multiplayer it becomes, the less control you have over the game as designers. And so on that tip, actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about what happens when you get these mobs of people sort of acting in concert. Thanks for the question, by the way. Acting in concert. And so for ARGs, it's usually an integral part of the gameplay is let's get as many people as possible together or in small groups to crack these puzzles. And I wanted to talk about a little bit about some video game parallels with that in terms of the types of collaboration and the types of things that video game players do that are actually similar to what alternate reality game players do. One thing that that Dan was talking about in a chat we had earlier today is the inclusion of, say, for World of Warcraft, which is an incredibly complex, massively multiplayer game with many, many, many facts and stuff associated with it. Players will actually set up a wiki just to keep track of everything. Did you want to tell people what that was about?
Yeah. So what you've got in World of Warcraft is you've got something called WoW Wiki, I think there was a guy, one of the admins of that site, was in a panel yesterday. So they have something like 300,000 articles. You know, every single time anything's updated in the game, then they instantly document it. And there are people out there who just love documentation. I wish I knew who they were and I could hire them. But actually, it turns out you don't need to hire them. With Perplex City, we had an in-game newspaper that updated twice a week with at least 10 articles. And there were throwaway references to characters, place names, buildings, you know, you name it. And, as with anything, when you are creating a world or a narrative, you have a story Bible. And although we kept one, there are many, many more players. Your audience is far larger than you are. Undoubtedly, you know, if you've got a staff of, say, just 15, there are, say, 200 hardcore people, you know, those strange people who love documenting every single thing and cross-referencing and go, oh, yes, they mentioned this, which means that this location in the city must be, you know, this far away because we triangulated it. And then they make a Google Maps mashup for you, and then you can actually see, and then they'll show you, and then they'll write a correction into the letters page. And you go, okay, yes, you're right.
And so with some ARGs, people actually develop tools to be able to play the game better, like Firefox add-ons.
So
that's parallel a little bit to, say, World of Warcraft, which has an extensible system where users can create their own in-game tools, and they create their own add-ons for World of Warcraft as well. Also, what you were talking about in terms of the newspapers for Perplex City, in some of these massively multiplayer games, such as City of Heroes, people will actually write their own newspaper, like interview heroes on their game server, and they are sort of, you know, it's like the Clark Kent and Superman thing, right? It's a well-known sort of trope in our Peter Parker and Spider-Man. So this is a world where superheroes live, and so to run a newspaper that reports on the events that happen in the various cities that exist in the game, players are always looking for ways, whether it's an alternate reality game or video game, to sort of extend that story world in their own voice and add their own spin to it. And it's particularly interesting for sharded worlds, like every instance of the game is on its own server, and so there's groups of players on each server. So you may have a newspaper for one server for one city and a newspaper for another server for another city. And interestingly, those things actually don't have to mesh completely. It's actually what the players are doing on this server in this parallel universe. Anyway.
Well, you know, I think that just about everybody here has been hearing about user-generated content. It's been drilled into everybody, really, for the past year or so. And a lot of ARGs and ARG-type things are really taking advantage of that. And they're very popular for the same reasons that user-generated content, that YouTube and anything else like that is popular. Because people do like to get involved, and they do like to feel like they have a voice and a part in what's going on.
And I kind of wish that video game makers would allow a little more storytelling from the players to come back. You know, not necessarily that they're going to respond to everything that any player ever creates, but to give sort of hooks and loopholes and storylines and ways that users can actually contribute.
I mean, you've got that in mods.
In mods, yeah, that's a good point. So Dan's talking about user-created modifications for video games. So, for example, Half-Life 2 has a whole tool set associated with it that you can build up your own game levels and your own scenarios, and there's actually nothing stopping you from making basically your own complete storylines except for time and effort.
And actually, that's something that the ARG community can learn from the video game community, because, you know, those are put out there, and then you could make your own Half-Life 2 Episode 3.
Right, yeah.
And but what's harder for an ARG producer, an ARG designer, is, you know, it is entirely possible for someone to stick up a site or something that pretends to be in the same world as the game that you are producing and that you're developing.
That's called ARG jacking. When somebody creates game content for your game that you never had any inclination was going to occur, and sort of there's nothing, the players don't know the difference between the two, and so they'll branch off and start doing this other thing that you have absolutely no control over.
Yeah, and you kind of have three choices there. You can either incorporate it, ignore it, or denounce it, I think.
Sometimes it becomes an act of rebellion, as somebody in the front row said. Yeah, so that's interesting too, is I guess if the players don't think that they're having an experience that they want to have in the main game, then they basically create their own game, which is also, I think, what mods is a response to. Mods is a way for players to modify the game in a way that they want to play the game, which often doesn't have as much eye candy as the original, but it plays really well.
Definitely. I mean, actually, just going back to one of the comments on people being confused or not understanding that content that is put up there is not necessarily real. I think there's a lot that ARGs can teach about media literacy and about evaluating sources. Just because something is on the internet does not make it true. Is something that I think a lot of people need to learn, and it is definitely by no means a problem of the ARG genre.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the critical thinking skills that you mentioned earlier.
Which I think, unfortunately, I think video games really lack that. You know, it's all short term. What am I doing now? What am I doing now? There's not very much long term. There's no opportunity for reflection in video game play, which, you know, sometimes you don't want to reflect. You just want to kill aliens, right? So it's a good thing. I mean, we're not here to say there's anything wrong with video games. We're just here to figure out, you know, what ways can these art forms blend together.
But
let's go to another.
There are times when, just very, very quickly, there's a good example of that. So so Half-Life, and I'm going to spoil it.
Wait a second. It's like a really bad spoiler.
No. It's an old game. You should have played it already.
So you're talking Half-Life 1, not Half-Life 2.
Half-Life 1. Okay. Right. Okay.
This is like 1990
or something. So Half-Life is, in terms of story, it's a very kind of on the rails linear narrative. You don't have any choice. It's not branching or anything. It shows you things in the background. And the interesting thing, one of the really big things about Half-Life when it came out was people were like, oh my god, this game actually has a story. You don't just go. It's not like Doom. I guess Doom had a story. It even had a movie.
Yeah, the story was find the blue key.
Yeah. but there was a moment in Half-Life where you thought the soldiers were coming to rescue you. And you're like, excellent, right, okay, because there's me going around with my, you know, Gordon Freeman crowbar and everything, and I'm just about to run out of ammo. And then these soldiers come in and you go, excellent, you know, they're coming to rescue Black Mesa. And they're not. They're here to take you down. And as twists go, and as, you know, in terms of an instance of critical evaluation in a video game and whether you should trust someone, that doesn't happen very much in video games at all, about whether you should trust an NPC or not. Mm-hmm. You just kind of blindly go, because, you know, how complicated can the story be in a video game? You know, it doesn't ever seem to be that, and it's definitely not that branching. And I think that's something that video game developers are definitely moving towards in terms of a narrative experience, and one that can definitely draw you in more. You know, why can't this medium be as moving and it already arguably is in some instances, than, you know, scripted entertainment like a long form movie.
Let's jump to a question.
Hi there. I'm more of an ARG wannabe. I work in higher education, and I really want to build an ARG that teaches someone just what you said about teaching media literacy skills or problem solving. But I think, I can't remember who said earlier, you just said like, oh, making an ARG is easy. And I'm in the back note, it's like, I've been paralyzed for a year because I can't come up with a story.
I mean, you need a writer.
I need a writer, okay. That's the problem. But that's the thing that keeps me from doing this is that I don't want to create a lame ARG. The layers just seem so complex that
it's not easy. I think what I was trying to say is the technology behind creating ARGs it's platform agnostic.
Yeah.
You can kind of do it however you want. So
The tools are cheaper and easier to get to. It's like blogging. It's like the democratization of publishing. It is easier to create content and get it out there, but that does not mean that the creative process.
Right. It's planning and developing it is a lot more. You have to be smarter than 100,000 people, which is,
I guess if you're paralyzed about starting, I mean, the one thing, I mean, we are really big on agile and iterative development at Six to Start Now. So as soon as, you know, get it out there, get something out there, start prototyping it, start playtesting it, refine it, and just keep doing that.
How many people work on an ARG?
It depends on the size and budget, the scope, right? So, for example, I don't even know if I can give examples. One of the things about the alternate reality game development industry is it's really hard to talk about. Personally, I'm up NDAs, a stack of them at home. So, I mean, you're looking at, let me compare it to different industries, okay? So maybe you're looking at a fairly medium to low budget television show writing team, plus you're going to need people to do all the front end work, so the graphic design and fake websites. You're going to need people to do all the programming and stuff like that. Maybe you're going to need people with telecommunications experience. But why do something big? If you're looking at learning how to do it, do a weekend ARG, do a one-day ARG, do a class ARG. You know, by the end of the class, this is, you know what I mean? That's how long you have to solve this problem. And just that's, take it in baby steps.
I would like to know in how many subscribers or players in each of your project to say like it's a success. I want to figure, is it the 10,000 users, 100,000?
So the question was how many people play ARGs?
On your different projects.
On the different projects that we've worked on. So Public City had 50,000 registered users on its site. And the uniques that we were hitting were probably hitting about 1 to 1.5 million uniques a month. So that's where we were with Public City.
I think a lot of games kind of run down to those numbers, but you've got a lot of different tiers of players. You've got the people who check the website once and say, this is not for me. And then you've got the people who check it every day and kind of play it casually. And then you've got the hardcore people. And usually the hardcore people is obviously the smallest group. And it can range anywhere from just, you know, a couple of dozen to a couple of hundred. And then as far as your casual and your look once people, you can have numbers like Dan was talking about.
I guess an indication as to the level of engagement was that for the main Perplex City site, so that doesn't include any of the story or narrative sites. We were averaging probably about 18 to 19 pages per session, which is
high. Page views, you mean?
Yeah, so 18 to 19 page views per session. And when you compare that to the number of people who just normally go into a site, read one page, and then bounce straight back out, that should give you a level of, you know, how involved the audience is. So while the raw numbers may not be that high, the actual level of engagement is incredibly so.
And how many people played Tor Game? Was it 100 teams or something, or 130 people? Yeah. So. You know, it's like you can have different types of games with different goals. So the question about how many people are playing is always has to be in the context of what was the purpose of it. So a grassroots, local, urban alternate reality game experience with 100 dedicated players who are actually literally running around the city and meeting characters and interacting with people and solving puzzles, that's a really successful alternate reality game.
Is there stats or published because I'm working on a few projects and I think my, like, the engagement of people is really, really high. Like, people go, I think on a website I'm working on, we have like 16,000 users and mm-hmm. this game is going to go along for 40 weeks. So mm-hmm. it's a really big engagement for them to play that.
I would suggest
they view about like 60 pages per session. It's enormous,
yeah,
but
it's
the sponsors
good.
Say, oh, well, you only have 16,000 people.
There's a researcher in cross-media entertainment called yeah. Christy Dina, and she okay. has a single web post that has the most aggregated statistics I've ever seen on alternate reality games and usage numbers. I can't personally say the numbers of projects I've worked on because I'm not allowed, but the clients were very happy.
Yeah, maybe because they know. I think my client, they don't know it's a really, really, like, we do good scores.
Right. Oh, incidentally, just because we're running short on time, we've got about 5 minutes to answer three questions. There's going to be a follow-up so-called core conversation that I'm going to be leading on Monday. It's basically an open conversation that's very informal that I invite you to drop by for. I think it's 1:30 p.m. on Monday, but I'm not entirely sure. Yep.
This may be a pretty basic question, but aside from having a major media partner like AI or like Halo 2, how do you go about attracting players to the game?
Good question. Who wants to start?
Marketing, PR, making a really great product.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to know like sort of specific mechanics, it's a trope of alternate reality games. It's very common to have a countdown site or some sort of teaser viral video or something like that. I mean, it's very similar to how anything else is marketed. And just, you know, just to quickly further on, if you run an ARG news site or if you're sort of a blogger that blogs about this stuff, you can occasionally receive like sort of insider packages like I did last week. Sorry, Jane, if you're here, I'm so sorry. And so the idea is to get the word out about this among influential bloggers and stuff like that. So there's a whole bunch of different ways to do it. Just think guerrilla marketing, viral marketing, yep. that kind of stuff. It's very simple. Anybody can do it. No, I'm totally kidding. Totally kidding.
Hi, I come from the corporate education world, and I'm really interested in seeing how ARGs can be applied in that kind of environment. But I think one of the barriers, I heard you talking about some of the data and statistics that you have for page views. I see a barrier around sort of measurement of certain metrics to show ROI, to show people are getting engaged. Do you, based on your experience, do you know of anything that might be sort of good ways to get those kinds of metrics or what you could even measure?
So the question is, actually, I don't need to repress.
No, she's on the mic. You don't
brilliant.
Need to repeat it.
Right. So the great thing about ARGs in the context of education, so we've been talking about page views and we've been talking about the kind of raw analytics numbers, the traditional web analytics. You have to realize that anything, and this is going to get slightly technical, so anything that has a URL endpoint, so anything that can be accessed on a server, whether that being, you know, the correct sequence of events through a voice XML, through a voice server, or sending an email that's got the right kind of keywords in it, can be tracked and logged. So the great thing about ARGs in the context of education compared to, say, broadcast TV is that with broadcast TV, you have a raw number. You have, you know, 200,000 people watch this program. You have no idea whether they actually, on the one hand, watched it or whether they learned anything from it. Now, with an ARG, what we're designing for Channel 4 is that for every single educational outcome, every single learning outcome that we are designing into the game, that's going to be tracked by a URL. So we will know whether that specific player has utilized the skill to get past that. So there is very, very fine-grained analytics there in the engine that we're building. So hopefully that should be useful.
The more you go cross-media with this stuff, the harder it becomes to then aggregate all that sort of all those metrics and figure out what the actual participation was. So the web-based thing, I think, is a really good solution. You guys probably had a really good idea about how many people participated in World Without Oil in terms of what areas did they go to. If it's user-created content, you know, the measure is what were the submissions like.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
I think I just precluded the need for you to respond
exactly.
to that. Sorry about that.
What he said.
Yeah.
Going back to the video games and alternate reality games together, earlier in the talk we mentioned that ARGs have a lower barrier of entry for development.
Yeah.
Now, video games, historically, in the beginning, they had a lower you know, barrier of entry to development where you needed more technical knowledge for them, they were not that expensive to produce.
But which era are we talking about here?
Hmm?
Which decade are we talking about here?
I think 10 games? Print high, 20 go to 10.
Yeah, are we talking? No, seriously, are we talking like 1980s, 90s?
Yeah, 80s and 90s.
Okay,
you know those days. But now we have games like Halo 3, mm-hmm. which was in the millions of dollars to produce.
Yes,
I mean, you can't just produce games for these platforms that we have. How long before? What do you see for the future of ARGs? How long will this grassroots entry into producing your own ARGs last? I mean, how long do we have before some corporate person finds a platform for alternate reality games and then sort of edges out that grassroots?
Okay, so
movement?
I think we have like 3 minutes. So let's just quickly. Oh, no, it's all good. It's all good. Dee, why don't you?
Just real quick. The thing about ARGs is that the developers are constantly striving for something new. They would rather not repeat things, usually. Rather not repeat things that have already been done. So it's always a hunt for what's new, what's cool, the new technology, and this and that. So I think that as long as we've got new technology coming out, which it's coming out at a breakneck pace, I think that there will always be a market for grassroots ARGs to find it, incorporate it, and use it.
Yeah. Okay, so people still make amateur movies. People still write fanfic. People love telling stories. People love great stories. You can go, you know, to your tens, hundreds of million dollar budget, or you can do something on a shoestring. I'd say also that the point about the developers, I think on the marketing side, the ARG developers, definitely want to be doing the next thing because they have to find the next thing that will hook the audience to get them into that particular brand. If you're talking to kind of more traditional narrative and gameplay, it's much more an iterative improvement process. So it's not necessarily about not doing what you've done before, but improving upon what you've done before. But in terms of will people still be doing grassroots ARGs? Will they still be creating grassroots content in the same way that people tell stories to each other, you know, down the pub?
And I'll just add, as far as the video game industry goes, you know, so much of the innovation comes from the fringes. We have to have the fringes. If we don't have the fringes, we don't have an art form anymore.
Yeah, so Portal was a student project.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was one of the games of the year. So, and you know, Narbacular Drop, which was the game that Portal was based on, asset creation, that was not an expensive game to make. And I know that, you know, so I've been talking to some of the guys at NCSoft in the UK, and students are coming up with some pretty amazing stuff. And developers and publishers, and you've got evidence for this with EA's Blueprint division, you can do a lot with a little. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that the market is not AAA titles. There is room for a lot more, especially now that distribution is much more democratized.
Okay, we have one more question, but it has to be quick.
Okay, in the short amount of time that we have left, I was wondering if you could talk about what ARGs can learn from video games as far as learning curve. Because when I discovered The Beast years ago, I was paralyzed almost immediately by, you know, I sort of found it, you know, in the middle of its run, and I was paralyzed by just the sheer volume of backstory and puzzles.
It was
already
too much.
Been
too much to take in.
Right.
Okay, let's.
And so
quickly,
I didn't feel like I could participate because I wasn't there from the beginning.
So I started playing World of Warcraft, and I've learned that I can't stop now. But the thing to learn about World of Warcraft is that there is, you know, it's a very guided process. When you start out, you kind of like, excellent, you know, I just got my first 5 XP. And then you level up within 2 minutes of starting the game. And then you're kind of like, brilliant, I have this new ability now, and I can use that. It's a very guided, there's a lot of feedback in that process. Now, with something like The Beast, there was no tutorial level. Or there is no tutorial. You don't know that if you send an email to someone, you will get something back. It's up to you to find that out. So that's definitely something that ARGs can learn from video games.
And from my perspective, having worked on a few ARGs that were actually geared towards casual audiences as well as these sort of so-called elder gamers or hardcore gamers, is, you know, you have to design in hooks for casual gameplay that will facilitate casual gameplay. So if, you know, they don't need to know everything. All you need to know is, here's the problem, can you solve it? And it's almost something you don't need to know anything about the story on, but you're still going to enjoy playing. So inviting you in rather than bombarding you with all this too much information.
Right. It can definitely be overwhelming, but what you hope for is, like he was talking about, with a player-generated wiki or guide, that is often more accessible to other players. A lot of games also have their own The Story So Far section on their on a meta site to help bring in the players. But it definitely needs to have something like that, and it could definitely learn more from video games about accessibility.
All right, so we're going to wrap it up for today. On Monday, there's a follow-up conversation about what video games can learn from ARGs. And thank you for coming. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Steve.
Thank you.